Psalm 95. Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massah. Rebellion and testing. When your fathers tested me, they tried me, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are people who err in their heart, and they do not know my ways. Therefore I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter in my rest. In the Old Testament context, and the Septuagint are just a little bit different. And the Septuagint is not inspired, but its usage by the author of Hebrews in the New Testament. In other words, Hebrews 3, 7 through 11. That's inspired. And the nuances are slightly different, so we're going to look at that. The author of Hebrews is saying just a little bit differently. But he's using the vocabulary and language of the Septuagint. So, and in this case here, we got tested and tried, and two very important Greek words. And we'll look at that a little bit, but it's their relationship how they're used in the Septuagint that is most important. The first one is our friend, we've already looked at it, perazo. Word for testing and temptation. We saw it in the end of chapter 2. And in our context, it looks more at the process of testing and temptation. And the second word comes from a word we might also know, because it's very important in the New Testament, dokimazo, which looks more at the results. So if I have a 200-pound climbing rope, well, somebody has tested it and said, it holds 200 pounds, right? It's a positive result. And if you weigh 220, you probably don't want to use that rope, right? Or if you have fishing line, you know, you could deep sea fishing in the Gulf and you have whatever pound test, but you hit a shark that weighs more and the line breaks, right? Well, it's been tested for this weight. And this is how God tests us. And we'll see this in our passages. We're supposed to pass those tests, right? The tests are, well, are you going to obey, which equals, are you going to believe and trust in the deliverance, the saving power of God, or not? So, did PowerPoint die or something? Error reporting. Yes, PowerPoint crashed. That's okay. Go away. All right. So, back to 7 through 11. So, we see that these toponyms are translated in Hebrews by the English translators. And we looked at the first place name pretty closely, Meribah. And we looked at the root word there, reeve, which is more often than not a legal term, a contention in court. But spiritually more often, it's a word for rebellion. If this comes up, we'll move on to Massah, which is translated tested in Hebrews, the day of testing in the wilderness. There we go. And we're going to see that many of the passages that we looked at from Meribah and rebellion also have this term, Massah. So just to very quickly remember, there are two Meribahs, right? And the initial context is when they sent the spies into Canaan, to check out Canaan. Two of them came back believing in the Lord on the basis of the many deliverances they'd seen so far. And the rest of them flunked. Therefore, that generation, except for those two agents that came back and still believed in the saving omnipotence of God and were not distracted by whatever else might be out there, those two got to go. So, and remember, we looked at the 10 testings that are referred to in 14:22, 10 times. This generation has tested God and what it means to test God. So the first Meribah is Exodus 17, where Moses is commanded to strike the rock. That comes right after Meribah, the bitter waters at Marah and Manna. And then the first Meribah. And then the second Meribah is described in Numbers 20. And that's when Moses failed the test. He lost his temper. And as a result, dishonored the name of God. Dishonored his calling and his commission and what he had been commanded by God to do. And because he was the leader and the example, he did not get to enter. And we looked at that in Deuteronomy. The results of the second Meribah. At two different places, too. We distinguish them as Meribah Rephidim, that's the first one, Exodus 17, and Meribah Kadesh, which is on the border, both now and in the future, of the Promised Land. And the two names that look so close in English, the Desert of Sin and the Desert of Zin. But S and Z, we can see that at least and know that distinction. And then we looked at the root and how that's related to Meribah. We won't do that again, but it's very common in legal context. Its basic meaning is dispute, if you will. And from that, quarrel, contend. Remember that Jeremiah was called a man of reeve, strife. A quarrelsome man, in some translations. In legal contexts, to bring a case is a reeve. A reeve is a case. A case is a reeve. This place named Meribah is constructed, right, by the inspired Moses when he names these places in Exodus 17 and Numbers 20. And really the most important context here is the lawsuits and disputes as they relate to God. The lawsuits that he has against his people, Israel, because they have failed. And those accusations against God from out of fellowship prophets, right, from kings that are degenerate and various other places. And so from that contend, dispute, argue, strife comes our word, best understood in our context as rebellion, contentious rebellion. So then we have our second toponym, which is Masa. Masa comes from a verb, Nasa, with an N. And its basic meaning is the same as the Greek equivalent that we talked about a minute ago, perazo, which means attempt. In its most basic and oldest meaning, it means to try to do something. And there are a couple examples of that in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 4:34, and this is a great context because These first two senses are both used in this context. So the first sense is just to try to do something. And the second sense is general testing of some kind. Like maybe you test that rope with a 200-pound weight. Does it hold it or not? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But you're looking at that process of testing. So Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 31. For the Lord your God, Yahweh your Elohim, is a compassionate God. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers which he swore to them. Indeed, ask now concerning those former days which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth. That's pretty inclusive when it comes to humanity. And from one end of the heavens to the other. In other words, since the beginning of creation, has anything ever been done like this great thing? And what are we talking about, this great thing? Well, the deliverance of Israel throughout this period. And we looked at that last week because this has to do with Moses' relationship. Verse 20, but the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace from Egypt to be a people for his own possession, as today. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and swore that I would not cross the Jordan, that I would not enter the good land, which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. I will die in this land. I shall not cross the Jordan, but you shall cross and take possession of this good land. So watch yourselves that you do not forget the covenant, the Lord your God, which he made with you. And then we have more commands concerning fidelity to their God. Verse 31, for the Lord your God is a compassionate God. He's going to keep his covenant. He eternally has sworn to keep that word. And the Lord is unchanging, perfect truth, does not lie. So the fulfillment of that covenant rests in the character of God and not the actions of man. Indeed, ask now, has anything like this ever happened? Has anyone ever heard of anything like this? Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire? And we're going to look at that. That's when they failed the test of the Shekinah glory. So the Lord was present in the column of fire. They all ran off. And Moses said, God is testing you. You know, whether you're going to believe him or not. And they all ran off. And Moses stayed. Has any people ever heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire as you heard it and survived? Or has any false god tried to go, and there's our word, attempt, tried to go and take for himself a nation from within another nation by trials? And that's also Nasa in this other sense. So the first is attempt to do something, try to do something. And the second is testings, trials, testings by signs and wonders. And almost you could translate this proofs, like our friend Docimazzo in the New Testament. Testing to prove something works, right? So I have tested this rope, it works. Trustworthy, pass the test. Has any God, should there be such a thing, tried to go to take for himself a nation from within another nation by tests, proofs, by signs and wonders and by war? And all those signs and wonders were 100% effective. All those tests. and by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes. To you it was demonstrated, that you might know. And what does it say in Hebrews and Psalms? You do not know. You did not know. You have not known my works and who I am. To you it was shown that you might know that the Lord, He is God, and there is no other beside you. Out of the heavens He let you hear His voice to discipline you. And on earth He let you see His great fire, and you heard His words from the midst of the fire. So that's the initial two senses. First, to try to do something. And it really doesn't say anything about whether you're going to fail or succeed or whatever. Just try to do something. And then the second sense is to test to prove something, like a hypothesis. And the emphasis is generally on the results rather than the process, as it is with our other term. Let's turn to Judges 6:39. Story of Gideon. And I will leave it to you to read this whole story, because this is great and it says a lot about testing in this story. But we're just going to look at this sign of the fleece, 36 and following. But the Lord does the same thing in His tests to get the 300 people. So these people might think they did it themselves. They might try to take the credit. They might not humble themselves and depend on the saving power of God. So He cut them down. They started out with 22,000 people, and then there were 10,000. And He brought it all the way down to 300 people. And when Gideon went down, He had 300 people. And so the Lord confused the enemy and delivered them unto Gideon and those 300. But in the sign of the fleece there, and those are testings too, but let's start with the fleece. Gideon said to God, "If you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken." And it was so. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece in a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not let your anger burn against me, but instead let me speak one more time. Please let me make a test." And this is a test expecting positive results. And you can tell from the context that Gideon is asking in belief. "Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground." God did so that night. For it was dry only on the fleece, and dew was on all the ground. So, go down to, let's see here. Well, then he tests the people again a few different ways to come down to 300 people. Verse 4, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore it shall be that he of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' he will go with you. But every one of whom I say to you, 'This one shall not go,' he shall not go." And so they did the test with the water. And then they sent all of them except 300 homes. Yet they were victorious. And then there is the test of David in 1 Samuel 17:39. Story of Goliath. And, David's talking to Saul, and he said, "The Lord delivered me from the lion and the bear, and he will deliver me from this Philistine." Saul says, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." And Saul put his armor on David, bronze helmet on his head, clothed him with armor, girded him with his sword. And David put these things on and tried to walk. That's our word. Attempt to walk. For he had not tested them. Now, we can tell that he had tested with positive results his slingshot and his staff on the lion and the bear. So he trusted them. He knew them. They've already been proven to him. But this other stuff that Saul's given him, well, he hasn't used them in any kind of battle. And he has not tested them with positive results. And therefore, he does not trust them. Right? So instead, he takes his shepherd's bag, with which, depending on the Lord, he has already been successful against these wild animals. So he does not take the untested armor. And of course, we know the story. He was successful because he waited on the Lord. "This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head." And that is exactly what happened. So then if we turn over to 1 Kings 10:1, this is Queen of Sheba and Solomon. "Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord," so again, the name of the Lord is at what's at stake. This was the basis for the plea of Moses, "Your name. Do not destroy these Israelites for the sake of your name." "Concerning the name of the Lord, since the name of the Lord was at stake, Solomon passed the test." She came to test him with difficult questions. Verse 3, "Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king," which he did not explain to her. So who unhid it? Right? This is divine intervention, I'm convinced. "Then she said to the king," well, also, you see that he went to the temple, right? "And then she said to the king, 'It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom.'" So she didn't get it, but the name of the Lord was still blessed. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord loved Israel forever. Therefore, he made you king to do justice and righteousness." So this is a positive result because of the name of God and the reputation of God among the heathen. Then Ecclesiastes. Chapter 2. No, that is not the right verse there. Hang on and I'll get it. That's what I've written down. Oh, I've confused myself. Just like Warren did playing the music. Misery loves comedy. Ecclesiastes 2:1. So, we have this section on futility of everything, futility of wisdom, and then futility of pleasure and possessions. So I said to myself, come now, I will test you, self, with pleasure. So self, enjoy. And behold, it too was nothingness, vanity, futility. So that's a testing with negative results, right? Flip on down to chapter 7, 23. Well, so there's a whole bunch of things he's been testing here. And we have a bunch of contrasts in the first part of chapter 7, 1 through 14, between wise things and folly things. And then we have some prohibitions. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. They're dumb. Don't do these things. Foolish. Also, interestingly enough, verse 21. Do not take seriously all words which are spoken, so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. So, when is it okay to mock people? Not ever, right? It's a constant temptation, right? How mock. If you've been on any of the social media, these people make you angry with their mocking of justice and righteousness, right? They make you angry. The temptation is high to mock right back, but it's never okay. Never. So that's a challenge. That's a test. For you also, there's an old blues song. The same people you meet on your way down or your way up, be careful because you might meet them on your way down. So it's the wrong motivation, but it's the right sense, right? The right motivation is also mocked in modern culture. What would Jesus do? There's not any context ever where you can't ask yourself, what would Jesus do? Because that is our perfect example. So that's the right motivation. You don't mock people on your way up or your way down because Jesus would not mock them. He would not. He would call out injustice and unrighteousness and did, but he did not mock people. There's a distinction. Or curse people. So, I tested all this with wisdom, the instrument of wisdom. So, he had some wisdom. However, he said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious, who can discover it? Now, he's still out of fellowship here. This is still a human viewpoint, but... testing by means of wisdom, by divine viewpoint, is correct. That's what we should do. But we become wise through experience, right? Walking in the light and exercising our spiritual muscles. That's how we get wise, by humbling ourselves, submitting to the will of God, and learning by applying. So Daniel, and this is a fun passage. You get to talk about all of the ancient Near Eastern titles and officials and what these things mean. Because we have, well, in the King James, it's going to say chief eunuch, I think. The Sar Hasarim. And it is a really ancient title that goes all the way back to the oldest writings in Mesopotamia and Egypt. So it's very interesting. But anyway, so Daniel, in verse 8, made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or the wine he drank. So he sought permission. He petitioned the commander of the officials. That's our term. It's a lot of different translations. But this is a guy that ran the palace, right? It has a lot of different terms. Major domo in the British Empire, they called him the major domo, the guy that runs the palace. Chief of the eunuchs. That he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor, grace, and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed you, who has designated your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age, the other princes in the palace? You would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. So again, we're looking at the outcome, the results of the test are what's important. And let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this manner, and he tested them for 10 days. Same word. At the end of those 10 days, their appearance seemed far better, and they were fatter. And all the youths had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold, so they were able to keep God's commands and not defile themselves with unclean food. And they did so in belief, right? They petitioned in the belief of the saving power of God, and that's demonstrated over and over in the book of Daniel. And so the test was resolved with positive results. So, let's flip back, and we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, because many of these things we've already seen, but it's interesting to see the connection between rebellion and testing, how that works out. The wilderness intergeneration and divine testing in general. So the first usage in the Old Testament of this type of testing is Abraham and Isaac, right? It came about after, this is right after the Abimelech covenant, came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Hanani, here am I. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. And we know how this test worked out. And as mentioned, right, in Hebrews 11, reckoned as righteousness. So that's the first testing, and again, the emphasis is on positive results and not the process itself in this case. Exodus 15 is the Marah test. It's the first of the 10 tests mentioned. Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah, which means bitter. We looked at that. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And they cried out, Moses cried out to the Lord. And the Lord showed him a tree. And he threw that tree into the waters. And the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and a regulation. And there he tested them. And he said, this is God, Yahweh, speaking, "If you will give earnest heed, Shema Yisrael, hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the disease on you which I put on the Egyptians. For I am Yahweh Rapha, Lord, am your healer." It's a conditional covenant. It's not like the Abrahamic covenant. It's not like the Davidic covenant. It is the essence in the apodosis, the first part, that's the essence of the Mosaic covenant. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms. And they camped there beside the water. So they flunked that test, right? Flunked big time. And then the Lord, he not only made the waters sweet for them to drink, but then the next place they stop is an oasis with plenty of food and drink. 12 springs and 70 date palms. So the next test is manna. They set out from Elim. They went into the wilderness of Sin, and the whole congregation grumbled. Most of the Meribah contexts are... they include Meribah, complaining. They include grumbling, right? Complaining. The sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt," because that oasis with the springs and the dates was just horrible. "No, we sat by the pots of meat. We ate bread to the full." For it's just like the opposite of Daniel, right? So they put out the feast, which is unclean, like the pots of Egypt. And he said, "No, bring me vegetables. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So they failed that test too. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from the heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I might test them whether or not they will walk in my instructions." So there's the content of the test right there. Will they walk in divine instruction or will they not? So the next test is the Meribah test, the first one in 17:2. So, and we get both of our Meribah and our Massah in this context, and we've already looked at this, but verse 2, the people quarreled with Moses, that's Meribah, and they said, "Give us water that we might drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with us? Why do you test the Lord?" So they failed that test too. Moses passed, though. He named this place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, that's Meribah, and because they tested the Lord, that's Massah, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So, Numbers 14:22, that's the reference to the 10 testings, which we're not going to go over again, but ten times they tested the Lord. 10 times they failed. But let's look at Psalm 78, which I believe to be critical to our context. There are three psalms, really. There's Psalm 26, Psalms beside the one quoted, Psalm 95, Psalm 78, and also 106. But in the time we have, let's look at Psalm 78, which is David's take in the Psalms on the wilderness generation, or the history of Israel, to his point. Listen, O people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and know, and our fathers have told us. We will not conceal them from our children. We will tell to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, and his strength and his wondrous works that he has done. For he did establish a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they might arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God. And this is this same context of obey by believing and trusting in the saving power of God. That they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, the positive proving by signs and wonders of the omnipotent ability of God to save. But keep his commandments and do not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation. A generation that did not prepare its heart. And what does it say in our context? Led astray by their heart. And their heart was not prepared to not lead them astray. A generation that did not prepare its heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God. The sons of Ephraim were archers equipped with bows, yet they turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God, as we just looked at, right? They were disobedient, rebellious, and did not believe, and refused to walk in his law, and they forgot his deeds. And we wonder, how can they have forgotten the oasis of Elim, the 10 plagues in Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, provision at Marah, provision of manna, provision at Meribah, provision of the Shekinah glory, on and on and on and on and on. But in point of fact, it is the challenge. You know, in the Christian way of life, it's no different. We do know the omnipotent saving power of God. However, when it comes to an actual test, you know, a medical problem, you know, or a loved one in trouble, you know, health, finances, or whatever, we still have trouble, don't we? We still have trouble saying, well, God opened the heavens, right? He parted the Red Sea. We are family. And how do you love your children? What would you not do for your children? And that's a challenge. It's a challenge to us, no less than it was a challenge to them. It's the same test. Again, don't mock. It's very easy to mock the wilderness generation because they failed, and they failed, and they failed, and they failed. But Moses failed, David failed, right? The greatest examples of faith in the Old Testament failed. And yet, there they are in Hebrews 11, right? So, they forgot his deeds and his miracles that he had shown them. And when you're in a deep, dark hole, it can be hard to remember because the hole is very visible and present. And the deliverance of God is invisible and eternal, but it's not right in front of your eyes. He wrought wonders before their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. That's Tanis in the Delta where they were slaves building stuff. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. He made the waters stand up like a heap. He led them with the cloud by day. He was even right there in front of them. And all the night with the light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness, Meribah, and gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He brought forth streams also from the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. Yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert. And in their heart, the battleground again, the battleground is the heart. And in their heart, they put God to the test by asking food according to their desire. So, if you put your desire above the will and plan of God, you're in rebellion. You're putting God to the test. Then they spoke against God. They said, Can God? That's just a question you should toss out to begin with. There's no question that should ever start out, can God? It's not useful. Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that the waters gushed out and streams were overflowing. Can he give bread also? That's another testing. Will he provide meat for his people? Therefore, the Lord heard and was full of wrath, and a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also mounted against Israel. Why? Because they did not believe in God, and they did not trust in his salvation. 40 years they saw his works, and yet they still did not know. Yet he commanded the clouds above and opened the doors of heaven. He rained down manna upon them to eat. He gave them food from heaven. Man did eat the bread of angels. He sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens. And by his power he directed the south wind. He rained meat upon them like the dust, winged fowl like the sand of the seas. He let them fall in the midst of their camp, round about their dwelling, so they ate and were full. And their desire he gave to them. Before they had satisfied their desire, while food was yet in their mouth, the anger of God rose against them, and killed some of their stoutest one, and subdued the choice men of Israel. And in spite of all this, they still sinned, and they did not believe in his wonderful works. So, he brought their days to an end in futility, and their years in sudden terror. And when he killed them, then they sought him and returned and searched diligently for God. And that's another test we all face. It's real easy to look for God when you're in trouble, right? A lot easier, a lot more present to ask for God when you need help. But you're supposed to search diligently at all times for the will and plan of God. And they remembered that God was their rock, and that the Most High God their Redeemer. But they deceived him with their mouth and lied to him with their tongue, for their heart was not steadfast toward him, nor were they faithful in his covenant. Again, the battleground is the heart. The battleground is the soul, the mentality, conscience, the spiritual Wikipedia that we build in our soul so that we can walk in light. But he, being compassionate, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. And often he restrained his anger and did not arouse all of his wrath. Thus he remembered that they were only flesh, a wind that passes and does not return. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Again and again they tempted God and pained. And this is the word uh, Well, we'll get to that. But the pain when God is insulted, they pained the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the adversary, when he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the field of Zoar. And we have the references here to the plagues, down to 51. Smote all the firstborn in Egypt, the first issue of their virility in the tents of Ham, Egypt. But he led forth his own people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them safely so that they did not fear, but the sea engulfed their enemies. So he brought them to his holy land. That's where the spies were sent out, right? At the border, Meribah Rephaim. To this hill country, Meribah Kadesh, on the border. To this hill country, which his right hand had gained. He also drove out the nations before them and apportioned them for an inheritance by measurement and made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. So even though they fell, God still fulfilled his promise. And the next generation did seize a portion of the promised land of their inheritance. Still, they tempted and rebelled against the Most High God, and still they did not keep his testimonies. But they turned back and acted treacherously like their fathers. They turned aside like a treacherous bow. They provoked him with their high places. They broke the covenant. And aroused his jealousy with their graven images. So that when God heard, he was filled with wrath. Right, just like Psalm 95, 26 and Hebrews 3. Filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel. That's the same word, disgusted with this generation. Loathe this generation. So that he abandoned the dwelling place at Shiloh, the tent which he had pitched among men, and gave up his strength to captivity. So there's the promise of what happens eventually when the patience of God, which is amazingly long, finally runs out. And his glory into the hand of the adversary, and he also delivered his people to the sword and was filled with wrath at his inheritance. Fire devoured his young men, and his virgins had no wedding songs. So there's the discipline, right? And yet, there is still a remnant, right? There is still a remnant, and God still is faithful and still accomplishes his plan, promises, purpose. Verse 70, he also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds, from the care of the sheep, the suckling lambs. He brought them to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart. Where does the integrity of God live? In the heart, the Old Testament language. And guided them with his skillful hand. So the Lord is still faithful. The Lord is faithfulness. It's a characteristic of God, perfect faithfulness. This is a really good overview of the problem, right? Psalm 78. And then, you know, it also is good background for Psalm 95 and Psalm 26, etc. From the divine viewpoint, looking back by David. So we'll continue next week, and we won't spend too much time on the rest of testing here, and then we'll go back to our context in Hebrews. Move on. So let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for your revelation that we do have the means. We thank you for our local lampstand, our faithful pastor. We thank you for the indwelling Holy Spirit and your divinely inspired word, for the perfect example and mediation of our Lord Jesus Christ. that we have all these things, everything we need, more than we could ever possibly need. So we do pray for obedience and belief and trust in the saving power of God as we walk our daily lives. Pray that we could be salt and light, that we might be faithful ambassadors and citizens, that we might be effective believer priests. And we pray that we might mindful, be illuminated for all those opportunities that you put before us, that we might seize them to the glory of your Son, in whose name we pray. Amen.